Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that nobody thought they needed, that weighed as much as a loaded pickup truck, and that saved more young men's lives than just about any fighter that ever flew. An airplane the pilots didn't love at first, and then would not stop talking about for the rest of their days. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar where we sit with the old iron and the old stories. Today we're talking about the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, the one they called the Jug. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the coffee hot this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and I'll tell you, the folks who flew the airplane I'm about to describe earned every ounce of metal you could hand them. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. It's the late 1930s. There's a company out on Long Island called Republic Aviation. Before that, they were Seversky, and the man behind a lot of the thinking was an immigrant engineer named Alexander Cardvelli. Georgian fellow, brilliant. And the United States Army Air Corps comes to Republic and says, "We want a lightweight little interceptor, nimble, quick to climb, something to go up and knock down a bomber." And Cardvelli starts drawing. Now here's where it gets interesting. The heart of the whole thing was the engine they wanted to build around, the Pratt & Whitney R 2800 Double Wasp, 18 cylinders and two rows. A big, round, air-cooled radial that was going to put out 2,000 horsepower, and Cardvelli wanted that engine to breathe, high up, where the air is thin and where the bombers were going to be. So he made a decision that shaped the entire airplane. He was going to hang a turbo supercharger on it, a turbocharger driven by the exhaust to jam air into that engine at altitude. But that turbocharger couldn't sit up front by the engine. There wasn't room, and the plumbing wouldn't work. So Cardvelli put it way back in the belly of the airplane, behind the pilot. And now he's got a problem most designers never even think about. He's got to run ductwork. Exhaust gas back to the turbo, compressed air forward to the engine, big fat pipes snaking through the whole fuselage back and forth the length of the airplane. There's a story, and I believe it, that Cardvelli designed the ductwork first, laid out all that plumbing, and then drew an airplane around it. That's why the Jug looks the way it looks. That deep barrel chest, that fuselage that swells out like the airplane swallowed something, it wasn't styling, it was that plumbing running underneath, feeding a turbocharger the size of a garbage can sitting behind the pilot's seat, and then there was the propeller. 2,000 horsepower needs a big blade to turn it into thrust. Republic ended up with a paddle-bladed propeller better than 12 feet across, 12 feet. And when you hang a propeller that big off the nose, you have got to keep the tips off the ground. So, the landing gear had to be long. Tall stalks of steel, but long gear was too wide for the wings, where the guns and the ammunition had to go. So Cardvelli built landing gear legs that actually got 9 inches longer when they extended down and shorter when they folded up, telescoping gear. Just to solve a problem that started with a propeller, that started with an engine, that started with that turbocharger in the belly. You see how this airplane grew? Nobody set out to build the biggest single-engine fighter of the war. It just kept demanding more of itself. By the time it was done, the P-47 weighed in around 7-8 tons fully loaded. Loaded up for a mission, she was heavier than any single-seat piston fighter had ever been. There's an old line the pilots had. If you get bounced by an enemy fighter, you can always dive away. And if that doesn't work, you can unstrap and run around inside the cockpit for cover. They were laughing, but they were nervous. Because the young pilots coming up wanted the sleek airplanes. They wanted the Mustang with that liquid-cooled Merlin sound. They wanted something light on the controls. And here comes this brute, 7 tons. Slow to climb. At first off the deck, they looked at that fat fuselage and they were not impressed. And then they took it up high. And then they took it up high. And then they took it into combat. Let me tell you what that airplane could do. First, the dive, that heavy airframe, that clean design, meant the Thunderbolt could dive like an anvil off a table. A German fighter could turn tighter, could climb quicker down low, but the moment a Jug pilot shoved the nose over, he was gone. Nothing could follow that dive and live. The airplane would build speed so fast the pilots were bumping right up against the edge of what anybody understood about compressibility, about controls locking up as you scream toward the sound barrier. Republic test pilots were finding those limits the hard way, so the combat pilots wouldn't have to. Second, the guns. 850 caliber Browning machine guns, 4 in each wing. When a Jug pilot pressed that trigger, he was throwing out a wall of lead. You did not need to be a marksman, you needed to point the airplane. Ground targets, other fighters, locomotives, trucks. That 8-gun battery would tear the target apart. But third, and this is the one that matters most, and this is why Old Man wept talking about this airplane. The jug brought you home. That big air-cooled radial up front had no delicate radiator, no coolant lines to shoot full of holes. A liquid-cooled engine, you put one bullet in the cooling system and the temperature climbs and the engine seizes and you're a glider looking for a farmer's field behind enemy lines. But that double wasp radial, pilots came back with whole cylinders shot clean off, came home on 14 cylinders instead of 18, came home with the cowling half gone. There are photographs, and I've stood and looked at them in the Museum of Thunderbolts that flew home with holes you could climb through, tail sections chewed to ribbon, a propeller blade shot in half, and that airplane held together and carried a scared young man back across the channel to a runway in England. There was a pilot named Robert Johnson. Bob Johnson. Early in the war, he got jumped, badly, over France. A German fighter, a Focke-Wulf, sat right behind him and emptied his guns into Johnson's Thunderbolt. Cannon shells and machine gun bullets poured into that airplane at point-blank range. The German actually pulled up alongside, looking, because he could not understand why the American was still flying. He'd put everything he had into it, and Johnson flew home, windscreen so oil-covered and shot up he could barely see. More than 20 cannon strikes and better than 100 bullet holes in the airplane, by some counts, and he landed it. And that airplane, wrecked as it was, had done the one job that matters: it kept a man alive. Bob Johnson went on to become one of the top American aces in Europe, and he flew the jug the whole way. Now here's the part where the story turns, because early on, the top brass didn't quite know what they had. The Thunderbolt was supposed to be a high-altitude bomber escort, and it did that, but it didn't have the legs at first to go all the way to Berlin and back. The Mustang, with its long range, eventually took over the deep escort job. And a lesser airplane, a lesser story, would have ended right there, outshined, sent home. But somebody looked at that 8-ton airframe, that 8-gun battery, that engine that would not die, and they said, you know what this airplane is? It's a hammer. And they turned the jug loose on the ground. Fighter bomber, ground attack. They hung bombs under the wings, they hung rockets, and the Thunderbolt went down low, into the teeth of the anti-aircraft fire, and it went to work on the German army. Tanks, trains, truck convoys, bridges, ammunition dumps. In the summer of 1944, after the invasion, it was Thunderbolts roaming over France, breaking up the German columns before they could ever reach the front. And this is where that tough airplane earned its keep all over again, because ground attack is the deadliest flying there is. You're down in the weeds where every soldier with a rifle is shooting at you, and an airplane that can take a beating and keep flying, that is exactly the airplane you want wrapped around you when you're down there in the dirt. By the end, the P-47 flew on nearly every front. Europe. The Pacific, where its range and toughness were made for those long overwater hauls. It served with the British, with the Free French, with the Soviets, with the Brazilians, who took their Thunderbolts to Italy. Republic and its partners built more than 15,000 of them. 15,000 more than any other American fighter in the whole war. And the men who flew it stopped laughing about the size. They started saying something else. They started saying, this airplane loved me, it brought me home. Let me bring you into the cockpit for a second, because this is the part I love. You climb up onto that wing. It's a big step up. This is a tall airplane. You settle down into a cockpit that feels, the pilots said, like sitting in an armchair in your living room. Roomy. That fat fuselage gave you space. Some of them said you could get lost in there. You fire up that double wasp and the whole airframe comes alive with that deep rolling radial rumble. Not the scream of an inline engine. A big round muscular sound. You feed in the throttle and that 12-foot paddle prop bites the air and you feel the torque try to twist the whole airplane. And you're feeding in rudder to hold her straight, and she rumbles down the runway and lifts off heavy and settles into a climb. And when you get up high, where Cartvelli always meant for her to go, that turbocharger down in the belly is spinning up, jamming air into the engine, and the jug comes into her own, way up there in the thin cold air where lesser airplanes are gasping. The Thunderbolt is still pulling strong, just like the man drew it up on Long Island before the war. That's the whole airplane right there. Every strange thing about it, the size, the shape, the weight, all of it traces back to one decision. Put a turbocharger in it and make it breathe at altitude. Everything else was Cartvelli solving the problems. That decision handed him, and what came out the other end was an airplane so tough it became a legend, not for what it was designed to do, but for what it turned out to be able to survive. There aren't many left flying today. Of 15,000 built, you can count the airworthy Thunderbolts on your fingers and toes. The warbird crews who keep them going, the folks at the big flying museums, they'll tell you these are complicated, expensive, thirsty machines to operate. That turbo system alone is a maintenance headache 80 years later. But when one of them fires up at an air show and taxis out, big and barrel-chested and rumbling, the crowd goes quiet. Because you're not just looking at an airplane, you're looking at the thing that carried a generation of scared kids into the worst place in the world and carried a whole lot of them back out. Next time you're at a fly-in and you see that fat silhouette, that deep chest, those long telescoping legs, walk over and put your hand on the cowling. And think about a young man over France with his windscreen shot black, flying home on a wing and a prayer and a Pratt and Whitney that just would not quit. For the history today, I leaned on the accounts the Thunderbolt pilots left behind, Bob Johnson's own among them, and on the good work of the folks at the National Museum of the United States Air Force and the Warbird Restorers, who keep these stories in the air. If you want more Hangar Talk, you know where to find us, over at RadioHangar.com. The airplane nobody wanted turned out to be the one everybody trusted. Funny how that works. Sometimes the ugliest one in the hangar has the biggest heart. This is Tail Dragger. Keep her greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.